I'll call the meeting to order. We have a forum. And would somebody like to move the minutes?
I'd like to move the minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dean moves the minutes from the January 17th meeting. Any discussion of those changes? All those in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. And now we're going to hear from the Department of Health. And on the Health Department budget, and we have the Commissioner Ellinger here and Dave Greeman, who is familiar with this room. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger. I'm the Commissioner of Health. I'm going to give a few little preparatory remarks to kind of set the context of how we're putting our budget together, and then turn it over to Dave Greeman, who's our budget director, to kind of go through more of the specifics, but also be around for any of the conversations and questions that you may have about our budget. As you know, the State Health Department is here to protect and improve the health of everybody in the state of Minnesota, and that's one of the things that distinguishes public health from medical care, is that we're here for every single person in the state, that we really want the entire population to be healthy. We want to protect their health, maintain their health, and improve their health. And it is in our state constitution that we need to be here to protect, because this government recognizes, the state recognizes the importance of having a healthy population. It is central to everything that happens in this state. And we do that, and you'll see in our org chart, you know, it looks really complex, but it really boils down to we do three things in our public health mission. We do health protection, to protect the people in the state from foodborne outbreaks, from illnesses, from diseases, you know, by assuring safe food, fluoridating drinking water, make sure that folks are protected from everything that we can protect them from, that it would be bad. Secondly, health improvement, try to improve their health from where they are now, because we're not at the adequate level of health that we'd like to be. So we're trying to reduce the occurrence of heart disease, reduce diabetes, increase the availability of healthy foods, encourage people to begin better exercise programs, reduce tobacco use. And this is where our statewide health improvement program, or SHIP, comes in, is the health improvement activity. And then thirdly, since we spend about 95% of all of our health dollars on acute care, on medical care, our role in public health is to ensure that we have high quality, that we have good access to care, and really say is our medical care system actually meeting the needs of the population in the most effective way. And that's why we really focus on how do we integrate clinical care with public health and social service, because as I look around the world, the places that have the best outcomes, have the lowest costs, actually are places that integrate medicine, public health, and social services. And our role is to do that at the State Health Department. We try to balance out and argue for a balance of treatment and prevention, because right now the balance is not balanced. We spend 95% of our dollars on medical care, and yet we know that only about 10% of our overall health comes from the treatment side. The other 90% of our health really comes from environmental issues, social issues, genetic issues, and behaviors that really are the focus of public health. And we also try to look at workforce. What are our workforce needs, both on the medical care side but on the public health side, and recognizing that we have inadequate supply of primary care providers. Broadly defined, primary care is not just the doc in a clinic, but it is really all of the folks that are first places where individuals come as the first step in getting health care. And primary care is the place where you can best do the prevention aspects of medical care, where you can really integrate public health, social service, and clinical care. And so that's, you know, the context of what we do. So when you think about our budget, when you think about our programs, think about health protection, health improvement, and what we do with the medical care system to make it the highest quality and accessible to everybody in the state. And we have a reach throughout the state. We have 8 district offices, and with our central offices here in St. Paul, we have over 1,200 employees throughout the state, really trying to meet the needs throughout the state. We really have a good, strong state and local partnership. We see that we are part of a team of federal, state, and local public health. So that's why we try to be throughout the state, providing technical assistance, providing data, providing services throughout the state. And our staff of that 1,200 folks really is a broad array of folks. Yes, we have some physicians, but not very many. We have nurses and nutritionists and epidemiologists and toxicologists and veterinarians and mortuary science specialists and sanitarians and health a whole variety of folks with a broad array of expertise that are out there really looking at all of the things that impact health, because it's not, as I said, not just the medical care piece that influences health. It's your drinking water. It's your food. It's the air. It's the environment. It's the organizations that are working collaboratively within the state. And as I think about the impact that our agency has and that public health has in general, I come back to this slide, which shows the increasing life expectancy from birth over the last 100 years. And in the last 100 years, we've gained about 30 years of life expectancy. About 25 of those 30 years are really due to public health activities, the prevention activities. And if you look particularly in the first half of the last century, you can see the jagged line going up at a fairly pace. One big drop in 1918, which was the influenza pandemic, and took a great toll. But you could see that it was kind of jaggedy, and that's because at that point in the first 50 years, most of the problems were acute diseases, infectious diseases, problems with food, problems with water, problems with worksite injuries. And that's when we really developed a lot of the health protection activities that come out of public health. That's where we started to do the vaccinations, the clean water, the clean air, the safe working environments, occupational health. But then you see that in the next 50 years, continue to improve, but the rate of improvement has slowed. Because at that point in time, the leading causes of death, the things that really reduced people's longevity, were no longer the acute diseases. They were still a threat, but they were under control by the health protection things. But we then started to see the impact of chronic diseases, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, stroke. And at that point in time, we changed direction in how we actually went after those. We embraced a medical approach to that. We thought we would treat heart disease, we would treat cancer, we would treat, as opposed to what we did previously of saying, how do we prevent it? When polio was rampant in the 40s and 50s, you know, we could have continued to build lots of iron lungs, but instead we invested in prevention and in a vaccine. And polio, basically, in this country, is eliminated. Right now, we have cancer and heart disease, obesity, diabetes as huge problems in our society. But we have not taken the prevention approach. And that's why I was so pleased yesterday when Governor Dayton included SHIP in our budget, because that is one of the most powerful public health interventions. It is the vaccination against obesity. It's a vaccination against diabetes. It's a vaccination against heart disease by doing the community prevention activities. Also, hidden in that last 50 years where we've seen slowing decline, really most of the decline was because of a prevention activities, and that was reducing smoking. The fact that we have really decreased the amount of tobacco use in our country over the last 50 years because we've increased the price of tobacco, we've put restrictions on sale of tobacco and marketing of advertising, and that's why, again, I was pleased yesterday when the governor included a tobacco tax in the budget, because it is a good public health measure. So that is sort of the context that we have. And I just have one slide here to show sort of what the impact that public health can really have. And these are looking at all of the studies that show the cost savings of various interventions in our society. And this just looks at the cost. And I have similar slides, but I won't show them today, about, you know, how it impacts overall health. But this is just the cost. The red line says what would happen with costs if you just did medical care, if you gave everybody access to medical care, universal access to medical care. You'd see that the costs would rise on a regular basis. If you added prevention in the clinical setting, that the doctors and nurses would do the screenings, the blood pressure screenings, the pap tests, the mammograms, if you would do those prevention things, they would save more lives, but it would really increase the cost. The third line is if you gave everybody access to medical care, you did the prevention services, and you did the community prevention activities, the public health activities in the communities, what would happen with the costs? Certainly, initially, the costs would go up as you implement those community-wide programs, which we've underinvested over the last 50 years. Minnesota is now 48th in the country in terms of state investment in public health. But if you did invest in public health, there'd be a short rise for a period, and then the costs would start to go down. The data are really powerful that the only way that we're going to get ahead of the cost curve, the only way we're going to bend that cost curve, is if we actually do include the community prevention activities, the SHIP kinds of activities that change policies and behaviors in the environment throughout the community, along with the medical care that we have in our state. That's what will really cause us to be a high-quality state, a healthy state, and a low-cost state. I believe we have the best medical care system in the country, in Minnesota. I truly believe that. I think our data show we've got the best medical care system. But we're still not the healthiest state in the nation because we've not invested the same amount of energy in our public health infrastructure. And I believe that if we can balance that investment for public health, state, and local public health, while we continue to work on our medical care system, we can become the healthiest state in the nation. And I'll just end my part with this statement that public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. The job of making our state healthy, of public health, is not just the responsibility of the state health department. It's not just the responsibility of local public health. It is the responsibility of everybody in this state. It's certainly the responsibility of my colleagues and other departments within state government. It's the responsibility of the business community. It's certainly the responsibility of the legislature, which is making the policies, making decisions that are going to impact everybody in this state. So we really look forward to working with you to develop a budget, develop programs that are actually going to improve the health of people in the state by having a good balance between treatment and prevention both the clinical level and in the community level. And with that, I will turn it over to Dave Greenman, our budget director, to go through the budget activities of the department.
Commissioner, could you give us a minute on what's happening with the flu epidemic?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The influenza comes every single year. We can know it's predictable, but we don't know the severity. We can't predict it every year, what the severity is. Over the last several years, we've had a relatively mild cases of the flu. This year, the flu is a bit more severe, and it came much earlier than traditionally comes. Usually it peaks the end of January, February, early March. It peaked earlier this year. And it was a fairly significant and widespread outbreak of flu. It appears that we may be reaching the peak of the activity. We're seeing some declines in other states, and our numbers of reports are now starting to slow. Doesn't seem to be increasing as rapidly as it had been for the previous couple of weeks. A little bit too early to tell if we peak, but early indications are that it's peaking. We have because of the planning that we've done over the last 10 years with some of the preparedness money, we've been really to be able to have a system where the medical system and the public health system have been able to coordinate activities so that we've been able to assure that influenza vaccine has been available throughout the state. We've been able to assure that hospital beds are available and that if we developed a surge plan for the hospitals and so that we know when one facility might be overwhelmed that we can shift patients to another facility. We've opened some new beds, making sure the Tamiflu, the antiviral medication, is available throughout the state. So it's been a good example of how preparedness training and exercising has really paid off to have a really good coordinated response to an outbreak that is more severe than it has been over the last 4 to 5 years.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Ellinger. I think you've done a great job on, you know, the flu public health messages and you know, those sorts of things. But I was wondering, I'm not sure if this is a role for you, but I was struck by about a week ago, there was an article about based on national data, that once people are hospitalized with the flu, it was like over half of the hospitals were not making the hospitalized person, who obviously has some severe distress at that point, accessible to Tamiflu, and there was another drug mentioned, and the prediction was that was resulting in much more complications and much more deaths. And it really took me by surprise that once people had gotten into the hospital, we still weren't doing our best. And is there a role for the health department to kind of monitor that and, you know, coaching with our physicians and others to just kind of remind them of sort of the on the treatment end what's best practices, or is that something that's more the responsibility of continuing ed and for practitioners, or you know, where does that responsibility lie?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the role that, and I've heard some of the same things, and I know that's why CDC came out with its messaging earlier or last week saying the Tamiflu should be given early on in the course, and it really will help. And it really was a recommendation to providers to improve their clinical care related to this. Our role is that education of the providers. We don't oversee the practice, but we certainly oversee the overall system. And whenever we see some things like that, our job is to really educate and make sure that the medical profession, the medical associations, the nursing associations get that information out to their staff, that the hospital association gets those recommendations out to the staff that are working in those facilities. It's more of an educational piece.
Okay, well, thank you, Commissioner, and thank you for convincing the governor to fund SHIP.
It was a good day for public health yesterday.
Okay, Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. Before I get started, I just wanted to clarify that the what I'm about to present is our base budget for the 14-15 biennium. So this isn't going to include any discussion of what's in our budget package. This is just sort of the starting point for you all as you begin to work on what to include in your budget this year. So I just want to be clear about that so we're all sort of have the same understanding of where of what I'm going to be talking about. I thought I'd start with sort of a real high-level overview of the department's base budget with all the funding sources, and that's on your first slide there. As you can see, about based on the pie chart, about 47% of our budget, if you include the straight-up federal funding and then the TANF funds, are from federal sources. This actually, the pie chart actually underrepresents our federal funding because about half of our MERC dollars are federal. Half the dollars that go through the MERC fund come from federal sources, and also a good deal of the special revenue funds there are also federal. So all told, we probably get about $60 million, or 60% of our budget from federal sources. I thought I'd talk a little bit about some of the other parts of the other funds that we use that members may not be that familiar with. People know the general fund, obviously, and I think most people are familiar with the Healthcare Access Fund and TANF. The state government special revenue fund is where fee revenue is deposited. State law requires the Department of Health to provide a number of services and to do a number of enforcement and regulatory activities on providers, on vendors, and on healthcare facilities, and also service providers. And we're directed to pay for those activities through assessment of fees on the people who are receiving the services. The fee revenue goes into the state government special revenue fund as non-dedicated revenue, and then is appropriated by the legislature out of that fund to cover our costs for the programs that we administer. The legislature also sets the fees that are charged for the program. Currently, the Department of Health has about 32 fee programs, and they generate approximately $41 million per year in revenue. The law also requires that for the fee programs that we have, that they over a five-year period, that they must balance out. In other words, the cost of operating the programs must generally equal the cost of the amount of revenue brought in through the fees. And every biennium we put out a departmental earnings report that goes through each fee program and looks at how revenues and expenditures balance out. The MERC fund is our medical education research cost fund. This is funded through a combination of revenue, a portion of the revenue from the tobacco tax, and an amount that's carved out from rates that are paid to health plans that operate what we call prepaid medical assistance or PMAP programs. Those funds are then matched by through a federal share through MA, and then they get returned back to the Department of Health, where they're distributed through a formula to hospitals, or excuse me, to settings where clinical training for medical education students occurs, mainly hospitals and clinics. Then the last piece of revenue is the special revenue fund, where we get about 14% of our revenue. These are basically revenue we receive through contracts with other governmental entities and also through private entities for performing public health services. The law does give us authority to enter into contracts for delivering public health services and to generate revenue through that in response to basically providing public health. So I'll go to the next slide. Out of our base budget of about $1,034,000,000, approximately 66 or two-thirds of that funding goes out in the form of grants to local governments and also to nonprofit agencies for delivering services. About 19% of the department's budget is payroll, and about 15% is non-payroll operating. The non-payroll operating is broken largely. The biggest piece of that is results from 2011, when the legislature created a special agency to deliver IT services through a centralized location for all agencies in the state. It's called MINIT, and that's how we pay for our IT services now. Instead of each division paying for their own IT services, it all goes through this particular fund to pay for MINIT, and that accounts for about almost a third of our non-payroll operating budget. We also pay for rent, building rent, through our non-payroll operating fund. Our staffing level at the department, our base staffing level, is 1,264 FTEs. About 135, or just under 11%, are funded out of the general fund. The largest source of our FTE staffing is through the federal funds that we receive. The next slide sort of gives you a sense of where our funding sources, how our funding sources have changed over time or not changed over time, depending on the source. As you can see, there has been a slight decline in the general fund, healthcare access fund, and Merck as a source of funding for the department. The Merck is the largest reduction, and that largely is due to the reduction that was taken in 2011 in the Merck program. There has been an increase in funding in our budget activities for the state government special revenue fund, special revenue, and in our Merck program. That's been in our federal funding, that's been our largest increase. So over time we've become more reliant on federal funding to pay for the cost of our programs. You might notice there was sort of a spike in 2010 and 2011 in the Healthcare Access Fund. That was the SHIP program when it was initially funded. It was taken out of there's no base funding though for the SHIP program at this point. So as you can see, for 14 and 15, the base goes back down to about 2%. The next slide looks at, I thought that since federal dollars account for such a big part of our budget and have such a big impact on our budget, that I'd talk a little bit more about federal funds, where they come from, and how we use them.
Mr. Gaming, could you also mention what would happen if the feds did sequester money, because I think it hits your department very hard, but not so much in human services.
Mr. Chair, yes, I can. I'll cover that in a bit, and I can also provide you with additional background if that would be helpful. Our largest source of federal funding is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that is the WIC program. That's our biggest source of federal funding. We use that to operate. Those funds go out in the form of grants to local governments to pay for nutrition services for low-income women and children. Our second largest source of funding is the Centers for Disease Control. We get about $100 million over the biennium from that organization. That largely pays for public health programs that address specific conditions like cancer, diabetes, arthritis, asthma, stroke. The CDC is also, the funding we receive from the CDC also pays for a large part of our operating budget. We rely on them to pay for a number of staff at the department who administer these programs. The next source of funding that we rely on is about $77 million from the Health Resources and Services Administration. These funds are related mainly to healthcare delivery in the state. They fund things like that we use that funding to pay for things like activities to increase the capacity of our healthcare system to respond to public health emergencies when those occur, grants to support the rural healthcare system, and also grants to support efforts to address workforce shortages around the state. So that funding mainly goes out in the form of grants. We receive about $25 million over the biennium through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for families, for children and families. This funding is largely through for the family home visiting programs, which the department administers, and this is largely TANF funds as well. And finally, the Environmental Protection Agency funds about $20 million of our budget, and that is largely for our environmental health area. Obviously, it pays for things like water quality testing and some of our programs related to indoor air quality, like radon, some of our asthma efforts, things like that. Does anybody have questions? The next slide sort of looks at, I thought it might be helpful to look at, and some of these slides you may have seen prior to, I think back in November there was a hearing. I walked through some of the same information then. This sort of looks at which areas of the department are most reliant on federal funds to pay for their services or their activities. The largest or the most significant is the Office of Emergency Preparedness. This is the area of the agency that responds when there's a public health emergency. They responded to the floods in northeast Minnesota. They also were part of the response when there were the tornado went through North Minneapolis as well. 99% of the budget for that agency comes through the federal government. So we receive in the neighborhood of $100,000 from the state and that. The next, about 80% of the budget for the community and family health area comes through the feds. This is largely through the WIC program. This is where the funding for the WIC program comes in. They also pay for, we also use, this area also administers early childhood home visiting and our pre-pregnancy family planning and positive alternatives programs. About 76% of the budget comes into the area of health promotion and chronic disease. This is the area that administers our programs that relate specifically to conditions, diseases and other conditions. This is the area where we fund our cancer screening programs. The next one is kind of a mouthful. The infectious disease epidemiology prevention and control area this is the area that works to prevent and investigate infectious diseases and they respond to things like that. They're responding to the influenza outbreak in the state. They've also been responsible for working or taking the lead on issues in response to fungal meningitis, swine flu, some of the other public health outbreaks in the state. The next is our Office of Statewide Health Improvement. This is the area that works on tobacco cessation and our SHIP program. And Representative Huntley, you asked about the impact of a federal, the sequester that actually occurs. Obviously, it was delayed. So when I reported in November, we were talking about potential cuts in health department programs of around 8.6%, automatic cuts if there weren't a budget compromise on the federal level. Because of the delay, the amount of the share of the percentage cut to Department of Health programs that would be covered by the sequester would be about 5.3%. I can provide you with a list of those programs, so you have a sense. I can get them to the committee administrator so she can distribute to the members. That I think based on that reduction, there the hit on the department would probably be somewhere between $22 and $25 million over the biennium in reduced federal funding due to a potential sequester if it does happen. We also obviously from this description we are heavily reliant on federal funds. Over the last several years, we have had a number of significant cuts in federal funding as the feds look at ways to balance their own budget. Funding for our lead surveillance program has been eliminated. We've also had a number of cuts in areas like epidemiology and our public health lab as well. The feds continue to look at, in addition to the sequester, they continue to look at other areas of potential cuts. Our, the preventive block grant, which is about $2.8 million, I believe, a year or something around that, is also slated to be eliminated this year. We don't know if that's actually going to happen, but we are watching those issues closely. The next slide gives you a sense of our how our department is structured. And this is sort of a preface to sort of walking through each division's budget at the department. We have four bureaus, as you can see. That's how we're organized. And within those bureaus, there are a number of specific divisions that perform the work that we do at the department. This is where the work happens, at the division level. and our budget activities actually occur at the division level. So what I thought I might do is walk through the budgets for several of the divisions to give you a sense of how they spend their money, where they get their money, sort of what their purpose is. If people have questions, I we're happy to provide more specifics as we walk through.
We have a question right now from Representative.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Dr. Greenman, is it Greenman?
Yes, Representative, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, just what, you know, we have this fiscal cliff coming up March 1st again, correct?
That's correct, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
Yeah, at the federal level. And they like to keep us on the edge of our seats, I think, but for some reason. But if it isn't resolved and we actually go over the cliff, what is the total dollar amount of potentially that we could lose in terms of subsidy from the Fed, from the feds as far as the Department of Health is concerned? Your best guesstimate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, what I said earlier was I thought it might be around somewhere between $22 and $25 million over the biennium. The reason it's not clear is the Office of Management and Budget is actually in charge of determining which, based on their interpretation of the federal law regarding the fiscal cliff and the sequester, which particular grant programs are subject to the sequester and which ones wouldn't be. And so based on that, that would determine which the more they exempt, to the extent they don't exempt health department programs but exempt other programs, then our share goes up, obviously, of what needs to be saved. And so it could either be higher or lower than what I just spoke about, but I think our best guess at this point is $22 to $25 million.
Thank you.
Area I was going to walk through was the administrative services area. This is the area that manages the department's budgets, make sure that we're tracking the funds we receive correctly, and they also manage the eight offices in Greater Minnesota and also the five metro offices for the Department of Health. The total budget for this area in fiscal year 14 and 15 is about $95 million. About two-thirds of it is for building rent and for the centralized IT services that I spoke about earlier that we pay for through this area. What these folks pay for in addition to building rent is a big thing that we do at the department, given the number of federal grants we receive and the diversity of those grants, the rules around those grants. We need a good staff to work on figuring out making sure that we're spending the money in the correct way, that we're making the right reports to the federal government to verify that we're spending the money in the right way. We also, this is also the area that has our funds, our general counsel, our HR. We have a performance improvement area as well that works out of here, and also our internal audits section works in this area. The first programmatic area that we that I'll talk about is our community and family health area. Their total budget is about $396 million. About two-thirds of that is the WIC program. WIC serves about 130,000 people on average each month in the state, providing both nutrition services and education services on the largest source of spending on the WIC program is on the vouchers that people receive. This is also the area that pays for that administers what we call our healthcare homes program. This is for those who aren't familiar with healthcare homes. These are essentially providers that clinics, other types of providers that are certified by the Department of Health to deliver care coordination. They have to meet certain qualifications, but they deliver care coordination to patients to make sure they're getting to coordinate all the care that they're receiving and see that they're getting the care that they need. And these facilities are, or these programs are healthcare homes are eligible for certain types of additional payments for being healthcare homes. Right now, we have about 214 healthcare homes in the state. This area also deals with our evidence-based home visiting program. They administer that program. They also work with our pre-pregnancy family planning program and our positive alternatives program as well. The biggest part of the general fund budget for this area is $44 million, which are local public health grants. These are grants that go out to our local community health boards. And this is flexible funding that the boards can use for a whole variety of purposes. It's a good source of revenue for them because they can use it the way they, within limits, they have pretty broad parameters about how they want to use the funds to meet local needs. The next area is the health promotion and chronic disease area. These folks, this is again the area that works on specific conditions. It tries to address things like diabetes, stroke, asthma, arthritis. Their total budget is about $47 million. As you can see, a big share of it is federal. They operate our breast and cervical cancer screening programs. In 2012, 17,600 women were screened for breast and cervical cancer through this program. They also help to fund our poison control system in the state. We have a statewide poison control center that can be used, that's used by hospitals, by families, by other law enforcement maybe. When they believe there's been a poison exposure, they can call this number. It's operated out of Hennepin County Medical Center. And in 2010, we received about 49,000 calls to the Poison Control Center.
Dave, I don't know if you know, but a couple of years ago there was a food poisoning thing, and I think your department was led the country in finding out where it was coming from. I don't remember the details of that. Maybe the commissioner does.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have, I think, one of the best foodborne outbreak control programs in the country, and we will identify through our public health lab the organism and do the epidemiology around that. Peanut butter was one of those things, and a whole variety of things where we can identify before the feds identify where the source was, and so we have several examples of that.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chairman. You just piqued my interest when you talked about peanut butter. The Trader Joe's peanut butter, I shouldn't really mention their name, but they're a great grocery store. We shop there often.
The address?
Well, anyway, there was perhaps a peanut butter incident. Is that correct, Commissioner?
Mm-hmm.
And what was done? We experienced an illness in my family because of it, but and the average person really looks at the jar of peanut butter and puts it down and goes back to bed for a couple of days and tries to get better and then, kind of forgets about it or don't really respond to it other than don't buy that brand again. So what became of that incident, and how was our Department of Health instrumental in solving that epidemic?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, what we do when we identify this, we work in collaboration with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and share all of the information, and particularly when there's a national brand, we'll get out the information to recall that product and look at the production site. So CDC will then look at the production site along with USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to make sure that it gets cleaned up and product gets resolved and any product comes off the shelf. So what we did was identify the issue, brought it to the attention of the CDC and the FDA and USDA. They then would recall and investigate the source of that.
Thank you. Chairman, is this meeting being recorded?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Trader Joe's is a great grocery store. I shop there all the time, and Coburn's too.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of suggest that either this committee or maybe my committee should at some point maybe delve into this a little more, because it's really a fascinating story of how these things are tracked down. And going back to the commissioner's discussion about how important public health is, you know, sometimes it's go to bed for a couple days and don't feel well, and sometimes it's life-threatening and even life-terminating illness. And the degree to which, you know, we have this system where food comes from all over the world, and as a consumer, it's in everybody's interests, both the businesses and the consumers, of course, and state government, to make sure that when a person buys foodstuffs that they are safe, as safe as they can be. And you shouldn't, as a consumer, have to worry about whether there's some pathogen in your peanut butter or other product. And our health department does an excellent job, but I think it would be worth exploring and getting a better appreciation of exactly how that's done. I personally find that to be a really fascinating thing. And we do have a nation-leading lab that, and I think one of the other products might have been tomatoes recently, and it's just really interesting. So I just wanted to put that out there. Or maybe we could at some point have a tour for members who are interested of the health department lab, because I think it's really a story that's worth telling.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there are a lot of products that come into our state, you know, food products, certainly, but also medications, just the fungal meningitis, the medication that was contaminated was the most, you know, one of the more recent examples of how we need a comprehensive public health system that does assessment and intervention, and then if people are at risk, to reduce those risks both nationally and locally, so that it is a system of federal, state, local public health working collaboratively. And we would love to, you know, talk more about it, because it is an interesting story. It is the CSI kind of things in the health department, with high tech and mystery and investigation and all of those kinds of things. And we do have some great scientists and epidemiologists and community workers in our department, and would love to take you through our laboratory, which I think is one of this is a state-of-the-art laboratory, which is one of the benefits of being at the state health department.
It was not a food outbreak, but this is a long time ago. I think it was probably 15 years ago. There was a meningitis outbreak in Mankato, and the department organized the immunization for that, and they immunized like 14,000 people in 4 or 5 days, which was tremendous operation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that back in the early 2000s, where there was a meningitis outbreak in Mankato, again, really working collaboratively with local public health to identify the cases, to do the epidemiology, who was exposed, and then getting the immunization medication to the people who needed medication, but also then doing the immunization campaign. Again, a collaborative effort between local public health and the medical community and state public health was a great example down in Mankato.
Dave, continue.
All right. The next area I'm going to talk about, the next section I'm going to talk about, is our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. This office has a number of functions. Mainly, it's sort of its overall function is to work on reducing health disparities disparities in health outcomes between American Indian and populations of color and white population. The budget for this area is the budget is $13 million. Over the biennium, of that, $6.4 million in general funds and $4 million in TANF funds are used to distribute in terms of grants to community groups to deal with health disparities. In 2012, they awarded 47 community grants and 8 ongoing tribal grants to address a number of different types of conditions, including infant mortality, adult and child immunizations, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, teen pregnancy, and breast and cervical cancer screening. The next...
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Greenman, if I could get some information about the outcomes that we have on this. I mean, our health disparities with our minority populations are pretty... Our disparities with our minority populations and across all measures, not just in health, are pretty stark in Minnesota and not a source of pride. And I think this is something we really have to work hard on. And if you've got any kind of evaluation data on what has been the impact of the grant approach, how well it's integrated with SHIP efforts within the communities, you know, I just really like to kind of see, now that we've done this for a few years, what are we seeing in terms of the real outcomes and if we've got any evaluative data that's starting to show the local impacts, because I think this is an area we really have to step up on, and appreciate anything you've got in the background.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leffler, certainly with the grants, the targeted grants, we do have outcomes from those grants and have been able to track those. But you highlight the fact that disparities are much broader than what we can deal with just this limited program. And actually, we're trying to incorporate reducing health disparities in all of our programs. You mentioned SHIP, which would be it's a nice place where we can also look at disparities throughout the state. If we go back to being a statewide program, we can really start to evaluate how some of those community efforts can work on reducing health disparities. It's also a way of making sure that we engage communities of color and American Indians throughout the state to be engaged with us in addressing this issue, which is one of the big problems we have in this state, and we'll be glad to get that information to you.
The next area is our Office of State Improvement. This is the their overall budget for the biennium is $20 million. This is the area that works on issues. They work on the SHIP program. This is our program that helps to address leading causes of chronic disease and prevent those conditions through a number of activities on the local level, including nutrition, physical activity, and tobacco use and exposure. This area also receives federal funds for tobacco cessation programs throughout the state, and this is where those activities take place. The next area is our policy, is our compliance monitoring section or division. These folks are the ones who go out and regulate and enforce safety rules in hospitals and nursing homes throughout the state. They do the certification, the licensing, and make sure that ensure the patient's protection and make sure that those facilities are operating largely according to Medicaid and Medicare standards. They also regulate health-related professionals. There are 30 different types of providers that are that the department has been is required to license or certify. We also, through this area, investigate reports of maltreatment, and this is the area that regulates HMOs in the state.
Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on the SHIP program. You know, just an observation, I guess, food for thought. I think the goals of the SHIP program are lofty and laudable, okay? I attended a local regional convention on the SHIP program in my area not too long. In fact, Commissioner, you were there. You spoke, if I remember right.
Yes.
And you noted that we had previously cut, what did we cut, $32 million out of the previous biennium budget? And, you know, and I and the people there were concerned about that. I had to leave early, but, you know, just one observation or suggestion. When I look at these programs, one of the things we know about government programs, whether state or federal, they start out with very worthy causes, and but over a period of time, they tend to just continue to grow and grow and grow and become, it seems, less effective in many cases and very expensive. In my opinion, a program like this is very worthy. We live in my, I consider Minnesota one of the most generous states, corporate and individual, that you could live anywhere in the nation. We have hugely generous people. I've seen it on the school board. I've seen it in my community. I've seen it just about everywhere I look. And if you would create a tax credit in the code for charitable organizations or organizations such as this, where corporations and individuals could give money directly with a tax, state income tax credit, you would, number one, I think, see a much more effective organizations develop over a period of time with better results, because private individuals and corporations would fund those activities or those organizations that created the most cost-effective and best results over a period of time, versus government that generally sets parameters that we all think are good intentions, but over a period of time just continues to grow and grow and grow, and in many cases become less effective. I'll just mention the welfare system, okay? Good intention to help people, but over a period of time, it's missed its mark in terms of lifting people out of poverty. So I'm just giving that as a suggestion for food for thought versus continually funding more and more money when both the state and federal government are on very shaky grounds financially.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenhagen, you make some excellent points, and actually that is one of the things that that SHIP has been put together, was to actually try to maximize the private investment in health, to really align the resources that are there. And in the first 4 years of the SHIP program, we've seen that a small investment in an infrastructure in local communities has leveraged a lot of community dollars, a lot of hospital community benefit dollars, a lot of business dollars, to say, with a little bit of infrastructure, we can make better use of those resources, so that we see worksite wellness programs evolving because of a little bit of work that the community, the SHIP program has done. So I agree with you that there's, we want to make sure that the investment that we put into health is actually aligned and maximizes its impact. Blue Cross and Blue Shield started the DO program in Bloomington, Richfield, and Edina because the SHIP program was there to offer an infrastructure. The Heart of New Ulm program from Alina really has blossomed because of the infrastructure that was there from the SHIP program. The programs that are going on out, the Partnership for Health in around Moorhead is really built on the SHIP program with a lot of community dollars, a lot of private sector dollars. So we're doing exactly what you're suggesting that we do with this program.
Mr. Chair, I would also say that every major corporation in Minnesota has a healthy behavior program, yep, for their employees. And in my part of the state, most of the shipment, or half of it, was spent on helping small businesses do the same thing that big businesses were doing. You have a follow-up?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, point well taken, Commissioner. Appreciate that perspective. And I guess maybe... then I would suggest consider amortizing. You know, you put the seed money in, the government does, but then, okay, let's amortize them out over a period of time. In other words, gradually decrease their commitment as the private sector and individuals step up to fill the void, gradually decrease the government's involvement rather than continue to see another government program just grow and grow and grow when the private sector is stepping up. I think your point is well taken, but I think that we could amortize our way out of it and allow the private sector to take off after the initial money invested. Just food for thought. Thank you.
Representative greenhouse. I mean, I think this deserves some discussion because, for example, a lot of our disease prevention and control activities, our epidemiology, could be privatized, but there is a public responsibility to make sure that those programs are always there. And because we have really relied on the medical care side to deal with our chronic diseases, we're not doing as well with those chronic diseases as we really should. So I think there needs to be a partnership of public oversight, public responsibility, along in partnering with the private sector to do that on an ongoing basis. We need to have the right balance in order to do that and to be able to maintain it on a long-term basis. I think if we shifted all of it away from some public responsibility, we would see those programs fade over as certain things became more prominent. They would get more attention, and then the infrastructure would go away. That's what we've seen with the reduction in the SHIP program. Some of those things were not able to be maintained because there just wasn't a little bit of seed money there to maintain it. But it deserves much more conversation.
Representative Liebling, and then we're going to Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually had raised my hand to ask a completely separate question, but I do think I need to push back just a little bit with Representative Grunhagen's comments. And, you know, Representative Grunhagen, I do think that some of what you say has some merit, that we need to, we need to use the private sector and leverage that appropriately where we can. But I think some of your general comments I actually think are quite off base, and I really want to push back on that because certainly it's possible and certainly it can happen that some programs grow out of control, but you picked on the welfare, quote-unquote, and your comments on that are totally not fact-based. And I just want to say that we're here in this public forum, and I really, I know you were here in the last couple of years. You had the opportunity to hear from the Department of Human Services about some of the facts about our MFIP program, which is what it's really called. And it's not growing out of control. It doesn't keep people dependent. And all of those points are really wrong, just factually wrong. So I just want to push back on that. We'll have more opportunities for members to learn about that program. There are going to be some proposals to improve that program and continue to have it help people become self-sufficient to a greater degree and so on. But I just think that to make those generality, which sort of to me says that there's sort of a blind faith in anything that's private sector and a built-in suspicion of public sector, and I think that's wrong. We see the private sector sometimes also go way off the rails on things, so I think we need to look and see that some things are appropriately done in the public sector, some in the private sector, and some, like the SHIP program, make a really good partnership between the two. But anyway, I think I would now turn to my question that I really wanted to ask, and that was to the commissioner, or to Mr. Greenman, actually. You were talking about this slide on the compliance monitoring. And I just wanted to see if you could give us kind of a really brief explanation of sort of the differences in jurisdiction between DHS, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Health, because this is an area where they overlap a lot, or it gets confusing for some of us. So is there a short, just distinguishing what they do from what you do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'm sure there is. Unfortunately, I'm not probably the right person to. I get myself into trouble, I think, and if I tried to explain that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we will be doing a report to the legislature about, because we've been studying, there is some overlap, there is some collaboration that goes on. We do have some jurisdictional issues that we're studying to try to clarify that, and we will be coming back with a report later on in the session that will give you much more clarity about that and some recommendations about how we can improve efficiencies and improve the clarity of how those programs function.
A good example of that is nursing home. The Department of Health looks at nursing home to see what if there's anything wrong with the health, the status is being delivered to these patients in this. Human Services comes in and looks at the payment side of it, but not the health side of it. So there are two different departments just doing nursing homes.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment.
Donald was next.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. I could yield to Representative Gruenhagen if I could be directly after him, if that's you permit that.
Yeah, just, Mr. Chair, just one quick comment, response to Representative Liebling. I respectfully disagree. I look forward to the conversation with you and on these topics, but and I'm used to being disagreed with publicly. I was on the school board for 16 years, and good disagreement is valuable because we can learn from each other. But I respectfully disagree with much of what you said. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Chairman, Commissioner, as I try to play with these glasses, they're fairly new, and everyone that finally gets these always comments on them. So as I look through your charts of what the Department of Health does, it is evident that we are so dependent on the federal government that should they financially not afford to fund our programs, we in Minnesota would have great consequences. You know, 66% of federal government to for statewide health improvement. 72% for infectious disease on federal government. And the list goes on and on and on. And did you know that the federal government is borrowing $188 million $188 million 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Borrowing to pay off and help states. So we here in our, as a culture, as a state, can't even take care of our own people without depending on other states' money, federal money. Now I recognize that as we taxpayers, our money, our income tax goes into the federal government, and rightfully so, we should get some back. Certainly, I think that's noble and correct, but we're so dependent on the federal government to even feed our poor and take care of them. Now, Representative Drazowski 2 years ago had a bill that would have all the agencies prepare for if there was a fiscal cliff. What are the agencies doing just in case money stops trickling down from the federal government? I thought that was a very prudent and wise bill. I believe it passed in the House and Senate and it failed at the governor's desk. But it certainly seemed a good provision, and I would presume that the agencies, even though the bill failed, probably prepared somewhat. So two-part questions to you, Commissioner. What have you started already, I guess it's the same question, in preparing what would we do if federal government did the money's end? So how are we prepared to do what was necessary for our health and wellness? And then secondly, I know this is a two-part question. I see that the public health, one of your slides says that we live longer. 25 of the 30 years of life gained in the 20th century are from public health improvements. And yet, Social Security is bankrupt too. So here we're living longer, more productive, healthier, working, paying in, yet Social Security too is bankrupt. So I'm curious why that slide would, you know, what your take on that particular slide, and then your preparedness for the ending of some funds from the federal. Thank you.
Well, Commissioner, just keep it brief on that. But, you know, this is not the Social Security Committee. It's the, we're dealing with the Health Department budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, we have a public health enterprise in this country where we really do have a partnership between federal, state, and local governments in providing the services that we as a community think are absolutely necessary to protect and improve the health of everybody in this. And it is a partnership because the federal government has certain responsibilities and resources that we don't have at the state level. But we always look at what is the balance, and as policymakers, you have to decide what is the balance that we have. We now have reduced our state spending in public health. We're now 48th in the country on state spending on public health, and we've relied for many years on locals to pick it up. The local investment in public health is also decreasing as a part of the budget. So my argument to you in the presentation I've been making is that we really need to reevaluate that investment. We invest most of our resources on the medical care side, and I don't think that's where we get the biggest bang for the buck. I think we have to reinvest on the public health side. We have been looking at what's going to happen at the federal level. We know that there are going to be some cuts, so we are looking at the programs that we we can maintain at a limited level? Can we shift some to the others? We've actually included some in the governor's budget, things that we really think we need to maintain at the state level if we can't get the federal dollars. So we have been looking at all of those in terms of contingency planning. But I think it does deserve a much broader conversation about really how do we best invest the public dollars to do the most public good. And that's a conversation I look forward to having with you. And as far as Social Security, I mean, it has been demonstrated that if you can keep people healthy longer, we reduce costs. We do reduce costs in all areas of our society. So we want people to die late, but as healthy as possible, with the shortest period of time, the shortest period of time of disability. And that's why we need to really look at a lot of the senior health programs in terms of making sure that people stay healthy up until the day before they die at a very old age.
Speaking of death, Commissioner, how many people have died from the flu so far this season?
Mr. Chair, I think we're over 60 deaths this season for influenza.
And does the flu stop at the border of Minnesota?
Influenza is a nationwide outbreak. Every state is experiencing a very severe outbreak of influenza.
Let's get back to Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Greenman, I thought you were through with the budget presentation. I just had a general question about vaccinations and flu, so I can wait until the end.
The next slide looks at
Mr.
our
health. Mr. Greenman.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The next slide looks at our health policy division. This is the area that performs research to monitor and understand the healthcare marketplace, conditions, what we spend on healthcare. They also lead a lot of our healthcare reform efforts in the state. They operate our vital records collection system, and they also operate the programs that support healthcare professional training and support our healthcare system in rural areas and in underserved areas of the state. The budget for this area is $191 million. As you can see, the biggest share of that is in Merck. This is where the Merck funds are distributed through the formula I mentioned earlier. Each year, I think about $41 million in Merck grants are distributed in the state to healthcare facilities and other types of healthcare providers who provide clinical training. The next bureau actually is our Health Protection Bureau, and the first division in that bureau is our Environmental Health Division. They have a base budget of about $79 million. As you can see, much of it comes from the state government special revenue fund. They do a lot of work around maintaining water quality. They do everything from making sure wells are dug correctly to testing water supplies, drinking water supplies, to make sure the water's safe to drink. This area also does a lot of our indoor air quality work. They administer our lead program. They work on in areas such as asbestos, radon, tobacco. This is also they also administer our program that goes out and licenses or regulates food prepared in restaurants. A lot of this work is done at the county level, but this area provides a technical assistance to those areas and goes out and does the inspections if a particular county isn't going to chooses not to do it themselves. They also respond to sort of contaminants of emerging concern. They refer to them as, these are things that are starting to sprout up in our water system that we may not have seen before, but that require investigation to determine whether and at what levels those contaminants might be harmful. So this area has a pretty broad area to work on, and as you can see, they have a variety of funding sources. In the federal level, they're largely funded through the EPA. The next area is our infectious disease epidemiology prevention and control area, or IDEPC, as some people call it. These are the folks that investigate, monitor, and address threats from infectious disease outbreaks in the state. They also operate our vaccine prevention programs throughout the state for make sure that people are aware of and get vaccinated, and also work on programs that provide vaccines to low-income children. They operate our HIV or our STD programs as well, and they test for when there's Representative Huntley mentioned earlier some of the foodborne outbreaks that we've had around the state. They're the ones who do a lot of the testing, go out and make sure that we identify where the problem is and how we can address it most effectively. The final area is our public, or not the final area, the next to final area is our public health lab. They have a budget of about $35 million over the biennium. This is, they do a number of things. They actually run our newborn program, which screens each newborn in the state for about 50 different types of congenital conditions that, if not caught and treated quickly, could lead to lifelong condition or medical conditions and potentially death. They also perform tests to monitor infectious disease trends. They work with IDEPC. In fiscal year 12, the infectious disease lab within the public health lab tested about 45,000 samples to determine whether and how infectious diseases were moving through the state. They also have an environmental aspect of the work they do. They tested about 41,000 potential contaminants or samples for potential chemical contaminants in water, air, and soil throughout the state as well. The last area I was going to talk about is our Office of Emergency Preparedness. This has a $30 million budget, base budget over the biennium. As you can see, it's as I mentioned earlier, it's almost completely funded by the federal government. These folks work on providing grants to local governments and to public and to healthcare systems to help prepare them for if there is any type of public health emergency resulting from natural disaster, an epidemic, some kind of illegal activity or terrorist activity. They also work on stockpiling any kind of emergency supplies that we would need in any type of an emergency. They work to develop plans so that when and if there is ever an emergency, we have a way of responding quickly and in an organized way to protect the public health. And that that is the end of what I was going to talk about.
Okay, Mr. Dean, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, Mr. Greenman. Part of the question that I had was on the flu outbreak this year and the availability of vaccines. And one of the things that I've heard about and read about is the strain has been particularly virulent in terms of who it's attacking. And we see teenagers, a teen, I think, last week from Texas died. Lots of otherwise healthy folks that seem to be hospitalized. Is that unusual this year? Is this a different type of strain, or what are the differences, or what are we looking at this year?
Commissioner,
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the pattern of flu this year is the more traditional pattern that we see with seasonal flu. The 1918 version and the 2009 H1N1 version actually were unique in that they really targeted, or the biggest impact was on younger individuals. Most seasonal flu, the elderly are, and people with chronic conditions are usually most, biggest impact was on younger individuals. Most seasonal flu, the elderly are, and people with chronic conditions are usually mostly affected. In this outbreak, that is really the case. However, there are some younger folks who do get ill and will die. Those will always get press attention because that's, you know, that is a more shocking kind of activity. But we're seeing that most of the severe cases are in the elderly, particularly in individuals over the age of 85, and those with chronic illnesses. So this, it's a severe outbreak, but it is following the traditional pattern of the older individuals and people with chronic conditions being more adversely affected. still affects younger folks, and that's why we really encourage everybody to get vaccinated. You know, everybody over the age of 6 months to get the flu vaccine, because they protect themselves. But also, it's been shown that actually, if you protect the younger individuals, get influenza vaccine, they respond better to the vaccine, and then they then keep their elders from getting sick because it doesn't spread to the elderly population.
Representative Abler, very brief, though. We still have to get to the board.
I just want to make an announcement on compliance. Last year, we spent some money to ask MMB to look into Department of Health and Human Services on their oversight, over their overlaps on compliance. And so if people want to be part of that dialogue, they're looking for people to talk to, and I can hook you up. So I think it's a valuable study. We spent money to do it, so we want to get the best non-overlapping compliance we can do. So thank you.
Any other questions? Then we'll thank you for your presentation, and now we're going to move to staff is going to discuss the various medical boards and psychology boards, and there's an infinite number of them.
Infinite, yeah.
And we have people in the audience from some of the boards, but we just obviously don't have a lot of time. We're running a little over, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, Lynn Aves, Research Department for the House of Representatives. I'd mentioned it would only take me about 5 minutes, and that's about what we've got. I'm just going to give you a real brief overview of the health-related licensing boards. In Minnesota, the state is allowed to regulate professions only if it's required to protect the safety and the well-being of Minnesotans. In Minnesota, there are 16 health-related licensing boards and the Department of Health who regulate approximately 47 health-related professions. There's some of the professions are licensed, some are registered. It depends on the type of care and the amount of risk and the qualifications that the professional needs to provide the services. There's a handout in your packet that gives you a pretty good basic brief overview of the function of the health boards. I wanted to let you know that the Sunset Advisory Commission reviewed all of the health boards this past year, in depth, reviewed their finances, their purposes, whether they were functioning effectively, and basically said, yes, you're doing good. They also addressed some of the budgeting issues. I believe Representative Norton had mentioned last week some concerns about the legislature stealing funds from the state government special revenue fund. And the Sunset bill last year included a section to prohibit the legislature from stealing funds from the SGSR.
Don't say stealing.
And Doug Berg is going to say a little bit about the financing of the board, since this is the finance committee that is significant for you to know about.
Mr. Chair, I'm Doug Berg, the fiscal analyst for the committee, and there's a second handout. It's one page that just says Health and Human Services finance health-related boards and small accounts. And as Ms. Aves mentioned, it just lists the accounts and the base budget for them and which fund they're in. There's only a couple things I would note on this. They're almost all in the state government special revenue fund. We have one board, the Emergency Medical Services Board, which is a general fund board. And I also took this opportunity to sneak three small accounts in here, which aren't actually boards, but the Disability Council, the Families Ombudsman, and the Mental Health Ombudsman on here as well. So you know those accounts are in this committee. Those are general fund accounts. And just, again, to elaborate a little bit on Representative Norton's question about boards and the legislature stealing funds, that is more of an issue in general fund boards. The state is inconsistent on how licensing boards work. Most of the health boards are state government special revenue fund boards. The fee revenue goes into the special revenue fund. The legislature appropriates it back to the board for the purposes of the board regulating the fund, and typically does essentially all of the money gets appropriated back. There have been instances in the past where the legislature has chosen to sweep balances into the general fund. In the case of some general fund boards in other committees, which I will not mention, the fee revenue goes into the general fund and the legislature appropriates a general fund amount for a board to operate. There are examples where the boards get a fractional percentage of their fee revenue appropriated back to them. That's not really the case here. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Abler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the newer members, we have a board system that we can be proud of in Minnesota. They are, some of them are very mature boards, some are newer, but they really focus well on protecting the public. That's their first job, from the people they regulate, and assuring very high quality and compliance with the state laws that we set up. And I like the term sweeping the balances. That sounds better than stealing, but just, you know, that's been done on a bipartisan basis in the past. And some of us have tried to segment that. First we had this, there was a big pot of money, so it was this tempting, and then we had pencil lines. The boards already knew, always knew what money they had, but it was just too tempting in shortfall times. So we put a pencil line. I had a bill for that. I felt so good about that. So at least we'd feel guilty about knowing whose money we were sweeping. And the Sunset Commission board had, our bill had a more strong thing about it. But the board shouldn't feel too secure. All you have to do is not withstand whatever section that is, and we can sweep away again. So anyway, we have a very good system. And if members have a concern about any particular licensee, either type or some matter with that, the executive directors are very responsive to return your call and talk to you about the particular matter with that group they oversee. So it's part of what runs well in Minnesota government, Mr. Chair.
And it's very difficult to manage these boards because you never know what their expenses are going to be. You know, if they have a big lawsuit, they got to pay the lawyers, and sometimes they go into deficit and they got to raise their rates the following year, and then there's no lawsuits the next year, so that it's a kind of a difficult thing for them to manage. Any other questions? Seeing none, then the meeting is adjourned.
Very good.